Chapter 4. La morale est dans la nature des choses. Necker. The less we love her when we woo her, the more we draw a woman in, and thus more surely we undo her within the witching webs we spin. Time was when cold debauch was lauded as love's high art, and was applauded for trumpeting its happy lot in taking joy while loving not. But that pretentious game is dated, but fit for apes who once held sway amid our forebears' vaunted day. The fame of Lovelaces has faded, along with fashions long since dead, majestic wigs and heels of red. Who doesn't find dissembling dreary, or trying gravely to convince, recasting platitudes till weary, when all agree and have long since? How dull to hear the same objections to overcome those predilections that no young girl 13, I vow, has ever had and hasn't now. Who wouldn't grow fatigued with rages, entreaties, vows, pretended fears, betrayals, gossip, rings and tears, with notes that run to 7 pages, with watchful mothers, aunts who stare, and friendly husbands hard to bear? Well, this was my Eugene's conclusion. In early youth he had been the prey of every raging mad delusion, and uncurbed passions ruled the day. Quite pampered by a life of leisure, enchanted with each passing pleasure, but disenchanted just as quick, of all desire, at length grown sick, and irked by fleet success soon after, he'd hear, mid hum and hush alike, his grumbling soul the hours strike, and smothered yawns with brittle laughter. And so he killed 8 years of youth, and lost life's fairy bloom, in truth. He ceased to know infatuation, pursuing bells with little zest. Refused, he found quick consolation. Betrayed, was always glad to rest. He sought them out with no elation, and left them too without vexation, scarce mindful of their love or spite. Just so a casual guest at night drops in for whist and joins routinely, and then upon the end of play just takes his leave and drives away to fall asleep at home serenely. And in the morning he won't know what evening holds or where he'll go. But having read Tatiana's letter, Onegin was profoundly stirred. Her maiden dreams had helped unfetter a swarm of thoughts with every word, and he recalled Tatiana's pallor, her mournful air, her touching valour, and then he soared, his soul alight with sinless dreams of sweet delight. Perhaps an ancient glow of passion possessed him for a moment's sway. But never would he lead astray a trusting soul in callous fashion. And so let's hasten to the walk where he and Tanya had their talk. Some moments passed in utter quiet, and then Eugene approached and spoke. "You wrote to me. Do not deny it. I've read your words, and they evoke my deep respect for your emotion, your trusting soul and sweet devotion. Your candour has a great appeal and stirs in me, I won't conceal, long dormant feelings scarce remembered. But I've no wish to praise you now. Let me repay you with a vow as artless as the one you tendered. Hear my confession too, I plead, and judge me both by word and deed. Had I in any way desired to bind with family ties my life, or had a happy fate required that I turn father, take a wife, had pictures of domestication for but one moment held temptation, then, surely, none but you alone would be the bride I'd make my own. I'll say, without wrought-up insistence, that, finding my ideal in you, I would have asked you, yes, it's true, to share my baneful, sad existence in pledge of beauty and of good, and been as happy as I could. But I'm not made for exaltation. My soul's a stranger to its call. Your virtues are a vain temptation, for I'm not worthy of them all. Believe me, conscience be your token. In wedlock we would both be broken. However much I loved you, dear, once used to you, I'd cease, I fear. You'd start to weep, but all your crying would fail to touch my heart at all. Your tears, in fact, would only gall. So judge yourself what we'd be buying, what roses Hymen means to send, quite possibly for years on end. In all this world, what's more perverted than homes in which the wretched wife bemoans her worthless mate, deserted, alone, both day and night through life, or where the husband, knowing truly her worth, yet cursing fate unduly, is always angry, sullen, mute, a coldly jealous, selfish brute? Well, thus am I. And was it merely for this your ardent spirit pined, when you, with so much strength of mind, unsealed your heart to me so clearly? Can fate indeed be so unkind? Is this the lot you've been assigned? For dreams and youth there's no returning. I cannot resurrect my soul. I love you with a tender yearning, but mine must be a brother's role. So hear me through without vexation. Young maidens find quick consolation, from dream to dream a passage brief, just so a sapling sheds its leaf to bud anew each vernal season. Thus heaven wills the world to turn. You'll fall in love again. But learn to exercise restraint and reason, for few will understand you so, and innocence can lead to woe. Thus spake Eugene his admonition, scarce breathing and bereft of speech, gone blind with tears in full submission. Tatiana listened to him preach. He offered her his arm. Despairing, she took it, and with languid bearing, mechanically, as people say, she bowed her head and moved away. They passed the garden's dark recesses, arriving home together thus, where no one raised the slightest fuss. For country, freedom too, possesses its happy rights, as grand as those that high and mighty Moscow knows. I know that you'll agree, my reader, that our good friend was only kind, and showed poor Tanya, when he freed her, a noble heart and upright mind. Again he'd done his moral duty, but spiteful people saw no beauty, and quickly blamed him, heaven knows. Good friends, no less than ardent foes, but aren't they one if they offend us? Abused him roundly, used the knife. Now every man has foes in life, but from our friends, dear God, defend us. Ah, friends, those friends I greatly fear, I find their friendship much too dear. What's that? Just that. Mere conversation, to lull black, empty thoughts a while. In passing, though, one observation. There's not a calumny too vile that any garret babbler hatches and all the social rabble snatches. There's no absurdity or worse, nor any vulgar gutter verse that your good friend won't find delightful, repeating it 100 ways to decent folk for days and days, while never meaning to be spiteful. He's yours, he'll say, through thick and thin. He loves you so. Why, you're like kin. Dear reader, feeling mellow? And are your kinfolk well today? Perhaps you'd like, you gentle fellow, to hear what I'm prepared to say on kinfolk and their implications. Well, here's my view of close relations. They're people whom we're bound to prize, to honour, love, and idolise, and following the old tradition, to visit come the Christmas feast, or send a wish, by mail at least. All other days they've our permission to quite forget us if they please, so grant them, God, long life and ease. Of course, the love of tender beauties is surer far than friends or kin. Your claim upon its joyous duties survives when even tempests spin. Of course it's so. And yet be wary, for fashions change, and views will vary, and nature's made of wayward stuff. The charming sex is light as fluff. What's more, the husband's frank opinion is bound by any righteous wife to be respected in this life, and so your mistress, faithful minion, may in a trice be swept away, for Satan treats all love as play. But whom to love, to trust and treasure? Who won't betray us in the end? And who'll be kind enough to measure our words and deeds as we intend? Who won't so slander all about us? Who'll coddle us and never doubt us? To whom will all our faults be few? Who'll never bore us through and through? You futile, searching phantom breeder, why spend your efforts all in vain? Just love yourself and ease the pain, my most esteemed and honoured reader. A worthy object, never mind, a truer love you'll never find. But what ensued from Tanya's meeting? Alas, it isn't hard to guess. Within her heart the frenzied beating coursed on and never ceased to press her gentle soul, athirst with aching. Nay, ever more intensely quaking, poor Tanya burns in joyless throes. Sleep shuns her bed. All sweetness goes. The glow of life has vanished starkly. Her health, her calm, the smile she wore, like empty sounds, exist no more. And Tanya's youth now glimmers darkly. Thus stormy shadows cloak with grey the scarcely risen newborn day. Alas, Tatiana's fading quickly. She's pale and wasted, doesn't speak. Her soul, unmoved, grows wan and sickly. She finds all former pleasures bleak. The neighbours shake their heads morosely and whisper to each other closely, "It's time she married. Awful waste." But that's enough. I must make haste to cheer the dark imagination with pictures of a happy pair. I can't, though, readers, help but care and feel a deep commiseration. Forgive me, but it's true, you know. I love my dear Tatiana so. Each passing hour, more captivated by Olga's winning, youthful charms, Vladimir gave his heart and waited to serve sweet bondage with his arms. He's ever near. In gloomy weather, they sit in Olga's room together, or arm in arm they make their rounds each morning through the park and grounds. And so, inebriated lover, confused with tender shame the while, encouraged, though, by Olga's smile, he sometimes even dares to cover one loosened curl with soft caress, or kiss the border of her dress. At times he reads her works of fiction, some moralistic novel, say, whose author's powers of depiction make Chateaubriand's work seem grey. But sometimes there are certain pages, outlandish things, mere foolish rages unfit for maiden's heart or head, which Lenski, blushing, leaves unread. They steal away whenever able and sit for hours seeing naught above the chessboard, deep in thought, their elbows propped upon the table, where Lenski, with his pawn, once took, bemused and muddled, his own rook. When he drives home, she still engages his poet's soul, his artist's mind. He fills her album's fleeting pages with every tribute he can find. He draws sweet views of rustic scenery, a Venus temple, graves and greenery. He pens a lyre and then a dove, adds colour lightly and with love. And on the leaves of recollection, beneath the lines from other hands, he plants a tender verse that stands mute monument to fond reflection. A moment's thought whose trace shall last unchanged when even years have passed. I'm sure you've known provincial misses, Their albums, too, you must have seen, where girlfriends scribble hopes and blisses from front side, back side, in between, with spellings awesome in abusage, unmetered lines of hallowed usage rendered by each would-be friend, diminished, lengthened, turned on end. Upon the first page, you'll discover, Qu'écrirez-vous sur ces tablettes? And neath it, Tout à vous, Annette. While on the last one, you'll uncover, Who loves you more than I must sign and fill the page that follows mine. You're sure to find there decorations, rosettes, a torch, a pair of hearts. You'll read, no doubt, fond protestations, with all my love till death us parts. Some army scribbler will have written a roguish rhyme to tease the smitten. In just such albums, friends, I too am quite as glad to write as you, for there at heart I feel persuaded that any zealous, vulgar phrase will earn me an indulgent gaze, and won't then be evaluated with wicked grin or solemn eye to judge the wit with which I lie. But you, odd tomes of haughty ladies, you gorgeous albums stamped with guilt, you libraries of darkest Hades and racks where modish rhymesters wilt, you volumes nimbly ornamented by Tolstoy's magic brush and scented by Baratynsky's pen, I vow, let God's own lightning strike you now. Whenever dazzling ladies proffer their quartos to be signed by me, I tremble with malicious glee. My soul cries out and longs to offer an epigram of cunning spite, but madrigals they'll have you write. No madrigals of mere convention does Olga Zelensky thus compose. His pen breathes love. Not pure invention or sparkling wit as cold as prose. Whatever comes to his attention concerning Olga, that he'll mention, and filled with truth's own vivid glows, a stream of elegies then flows. Thus you, Yazykov, with perfection, with all the surgings of your heart, sing God knows whom in splendid art, sweet elegies, whose full collection will on some future day relate the uncut story of your fate. But hush! A strident critic rises and bids us cast away the crown of elegy in all its guises, and to our rhyming guild calls down, Have done with all your lamentations, your endless croakings and gyrations on former days and times of yore. Enough now, sing of something more. You're right. And will you point with praises to trumpet, mask, and dagger too, and bid us thuswise to renew our stock of dead ideas and phrases? Is that it, friend? Far from it. Nay, write odes, good sirs, write odes, I say. The way they did in former ages, those mighty years still rich in fame, just solemn odes? On all our pages? Oh, come now, friend, it's all the same. Recall the satirist, good brother, and his sly odist in The Other. Do you find him more pleasing, pray, than our glum rhymesters of today? Your elegy lacks all perception. Its want of purpose is a crime, whereas the ode has aims sublime. One might to this take sharp exception, but I'll be mute. I don't propose to bring two centuries to blows. By thoughts of fame and freedom smitten, Vladimir's stormy soul grew wings. What odes indeed he might have written, but Olga didn't read the things. How oft have tearful poets chances to read their works before the glances of those they love? Good sense declares that no reward on earth compares. How blessed, shy lover, to be granted to read to her for whom you long, the very object of your song, a beauty languid and enchanted. Ah, blessed indeed, although it's true, she may be dreaming not of you. But I, my fancies, fruits and flowers, those dreams and harmonies I tend, am quite content to read for hours to my old nurse, my childhood's friend. Or sometimes, after dinner's dreary, when some good neighbour drops in weary, I'll corner him and catch his coat and stuff him with the play I wrote. Or else, and here I'm far from jesting, when off beside my lake I climb, beset with yearning and with rhyme, I scare a flock of ducks from resting, and hearing my sweet stanzas soar, they flap their wings and fly from shore. And as I watch them disappearing, a hunter hidden in the brush damns poetry for interfering, and, whistling, fires with a rush. Each has his own preoccupation, his favourite sport or avocation. One aims a gun at ducks on high, one is entranced by rhyme, as I. One swats at flies in mindless folly, one dreams of ruling multitudes. One craves the scent that war exudes, one likes to bask in melancholy. One occupies himself with wine, and good and bad all intertwine. But what of our Eugene this while? Have patience, friends, I beg you pray. I'll tell it all in detailed style and show you how he spent each day. Onegin lived in his own heaven. In summer, he'd get up by 7 and, lightly clad, would take a stroll down to the stream below the knoll. Gulnar's proud singer, his example, he'd swim across this Hellespont. Then afterwards, as was his wont, he'd drink his coffee, sometimes sample the pages of some dull review, and then he'd dress. Long rambles, reading, slumber's blisses, the burbling brook, the wooded shade, at times the fresh and youthful kisses of white-skinned, dark-eyed country maid. A horse of spirit fit to bridle, a dinner fanciful and idle, a bottle of some sparkling wine, seclusion, quiet. These, in fine, were my Onegin's saintly pleasures, to which he yielded one by one, unmoved to count beneath the sun fair summer's days and careless treasures, unmindful too of town or friends and their dull means to festive ends. Our northern summers, though, are versions of southern winters, this is clear, and though we're loath to cast aspersions, they seem to go before they're here. The sky breathed autumn, turned and darkled. The friendly sun less often sparkled. The days grew short, and as they sped, the wood, with mournful murmur, shed its wondrous veil to stand uncovered. The fields all lay in misty peace. The caravan of cackling geese turned south, and all around there hovered the sombre season near at hand. November marched across the land. The dawn arises, cold and cheerless. The empty fields in silence wait, and on the road, grown lean and fearless, the wolf appears with hungry mate. Catching the scent, the road horse quivers and snorts in fear. The traveller shivers and flies uphill with all his speed. No more at dawn does shepherd need to drive the cows outside with ringing, nor does his horn at midday sound the call that brings them gathering round. Inside her hut a girl is singing, and by the matchwood's crackling light she spins away the wintry night. The frost already cracks and crunches, the fields are silver where they froze, and you, good reader, with your hunches, expect the rhyme, so take it, rose. No fine parquet could hope to muster the ice-clad river's glassy lustre. The joyous tribe of boys berates and cuts the ice with ringing skates. A waddling red-foot goose now scurries to swim upon the water's breast. He treads the ice with care to test, and down he goes. The first snow flurries come flitting, flicking, swirling round to fall like stars upon the ground. But how is one, in this dull season, to help the rural day go by? Take walks? The views give little reason when only bareness greets the eye. Go ride the steppes, harsh open spaces? Your mount, if put to try his paces on treacherous ice in blunted shoe, is sure to fall, and so will you. So, stay beneath your roof, try reading. Here's Pratt, or better, Walter Scott. Or check accounts. You'd rather not? Then rage or drink. Somehow proceeding, this night will pass. The next one, too, and grandly you'll see winter through. Child Harold-like, Onegin ponders, adrift in idle, slothful ways. From bed to icy bath he wanders, and then at home all day he stays. Alone and sunk in calculation, his only form of recreation, the game of billiards, all day through, with just two balls and blunted cue. But as the rural dusk encroaches, the cue's forgot, the billiards fade. Before the hearth the table's laid, he waits. At last his guest approaches. It's Lenski's troika, three fine roans. Come on, let's dine, my stomach groans. Moët, that wine most blessed and heady, or Veuve Clicquot, the finest class, is brought in, bottle chilled and ready, and set beside the poet's glass. Like Hippocrene, it sparkles brightly, it fizzes, foams, and bubbles lightly, a simile in many ways. It charmed me, too, in other days. For its sake once I squandered gladly my last poor pence, remember, friend? Its magic stream brought forth no end of acting foolish, raving madly, and oh, how many jests and rhymes and arguments and happy times. But all that foamy, frothy wheezing just plays my stomach false, I fear, and nowadays I find more pleasing sedate Bordeaux's good, quiet cheer. Ai, I find, is much too risky. Ai is like a mistress, frisky, vivacious, brilliant, and too light. But you, Bordeaux, I find just right. You're like a comrade, ever steady, prepared in trials or in grief to render service, give relief, and when we wish it, always ready to share a quiet evening's end. Long live Bordeaux, our noble friend. The fire goes out. The coal, still gleaming, takes on a film of ash and pales. The rising vapours, faintly streaming, curl out of sight. The hearth exhales a breath of warmth. The pipe smoke passes up chimney flue. The sparkling glasses stand fizzing on the table yet. With evening's gloom, the day has set. I'm fond of friendly conversation and of a friendly glass or two, at dusk or entre chien et loup, as people say without translation, though why they do I hardly know. But listen as our friends speak low. And how are our dear neighbours faring? Tatiana and your Olga, pray. Just half a glass, old boy, be sparing. The family's well, I think I'd say. They send you greetings and affection. Oh, God, my friend, what sheer perfection in Olga's breast. What shoulders, too, and what a soul. Come, visit, do. You ought to, really, they'll be flattered. Or judge yourself how it must look. You dropped in twice and closed the book. Since then, it seems, they've hardly mattered. In fact, good Lord, my wits are bleak. You've been invited there next week. Tatiana's name day celebration is Saturday. Her mother sent, and Olga too, an invitation. Now don't refuse, it's time you went.
There'll be a crush and lots of babble and all that crowd of local rabble.
Why, not at all. They just intend to have the family, that's all, friend. Come on, let's go. Do me the favour.
All right, I'll go.
Well done, first class. And with these words he drained his glass in toast to his attractive neighbour, and then waxed voluble once more in talk of Olga. Love's a bore. So Lenski soared as he awaited his wedding day 2 weeks ahead. With joy his heart anticipated the mysteries of the marriage bed and love's sweet crown of jubilations. But Hymen's cares and tribulations, the frigid, yawning days to be, he never pictured once, not he. While we,
the foes of Hymen's banner, perceive full well that home life means but one long string of dreary scenes in La Fontaine's insipid manner. But my poor Lenski, deep at heart, was born to play this very part. Yes, he was loved, beyond deceiving, or so at least with joy he thought. Oh, blessed is he who lives believing, who takes cold intellect for naught, who rests within the heart's sweet places, as does a drunk in sleep's embraces, or as, more tenderly I'd say, a butterfly in blooms of May. But wretched he who's too far-sighted, whose head is never fancy-stirred, who hates all gestures, each warm word, as sentiments to be derided, whose heart experience has cooled, and barred from being loved or fooled.